Trailblazing movie director Susan Seidelman shares a funny and insightful first-person story of her life, from her Twiggy-obsessed girlhood to the Madonna mania of the 80s and beyond, in her memoir, Desperately Seeking Something, a memoir about movies, mothers, and material girls. Her films reflect a passion for classic Hollywood storytelling mixed with a playful new wave of spirit informed by her years living in downtown New York City. Susan will be at An Evening with Susan Seidelman in conversation with Jessica Hecht at Images Cinema on Wednesday, July 17th at 7 p.m. Again, the name of the book is Desperately Seeking Something, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Susan Seidelman to the roundtable this morning. Susan, thanks so much for being with us.
And thank you for having me.
It's really nice to have you here. I so enjoyed this book. It was really a great, so much fun to read and fascinating. What brought you to the idea to say, okay, now's the time to do this?
Yeah, there were a couple of things. One was the pandemic. I suddenly found myself with a lot of free time on my hands, and I had a lot of time to think about things. And basically, I didn't start out wanting to write a memoir. I just started taking notes about my past, about things I remembered. And pretty soon I had about 200 notes, and I started to shuffle them around and realized that maybe this was a book. But I think the other thing was that I was also reaching a stage in my life. When the pandemic started, I was around 68. You know, I suddenly started thinking just about the passage of time and mortality, and weirdly enough, a friend of mine, Mark Blum, who was one of the actors in Desperately Seeking Susan, was one of the first victims of COVID. And so it gets your mind to think. And so that's what motivated me to write this.
You point out in the book, I mean, this was something you were determined to become a filmmaker. That's what you wanted to be.
I wasn't determined at first to be a filmmaker. At first, I thought I wanted to be a fashion designer. And I think that that's kind of reflected in some of the movies I made. But then I became determined to have those fashions move, to tell stories, and to set it all to music, and realize that filmmaking was about combining all those things. And also, I think that there were certain kinds of female characters that I hadn't seen on film, especially when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, that I thought I wanted to tell stories about.
Why was, when you started out, what were the challenges that you faced right away?
Well, I think the biggest challenge, and I started out going to film school in the mid-70s, was that there weren't any American filmmakers except one. That was Elaine May, who had done a movie I had seen called The Heartbreak Kid, which I liked. But that was a challenge. No women were being hired to direct movies. But I also think that part of the blessing for me was that I was a little bit ignorant. I did not know how bad the statistics were or how hard it might be to break into Hollywood at that time. And my naivete kept me making films and ultimately making a low budget movie that got some attention and that opened some doors for me in Hollywood.
Did you always know what you wanted to say with your filmmaking, in the sense of the message, the ideas of the type of films that you wanted to make, that you were comfortable making?
I knew I wanted to tell stories about strong and complicated female characters. And I knew that a lot of the movies that I liked, especially in my formative years in film school in the 70s, had these really complicated and interesting male protagonists like Jack Nicholson in Cuckoo's Nest or Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate or Midnight Cowboy, and that there weren't too many complicated and interesting female characters. And by interesting, I mean that I didn't care about whether the female characters were sympathetic or likable. I just wanted them to be as dynamic as the male characters I had seen. So that was a motivation for me.
How did that go over in Hollywood? When you say, okay, this is what I want to do, then how is that accepted?
Well, I started out, I knew that if I went, and I did go to LA when I got out of film school, I knew I could knock on doors until my fists were bloody, and I probably wouldn't get hired to make even a low budget movie. So I decided to hire myself. And basically that's what I did when I made Smithereens, which was made for about $40,000, but ended up getting into the Cannes Film Festival. And that, you know, having gotten a film into the, you know, the biggest festival in the world, opened doors for me. So suddenly I was able to jump to the head of the line, so to speak. And that's when I got a deal with Orion Pictures, which was one of the studios out there, and got to make Desperately Seeking Susan. And that changed my life.
Let me go back to Smithereens just for a second. Not only does it compete at Cannes, but the first American indie film to do so.
Yeah, that was pretty surprising for me. I mean, I kind of went to the festival feeling like Alice in Wonderland because I had entered this other world I knew nothing about. It was a big surprise. But as I said, it was because of that I was able to get an agent. They came knocking on my door other than, you know, it wasn't the other way around. And I got this script sent to me out of the blue after reading a lot of bad scripts called Desperately Seeking Susan that just happened to have my name in the title. So I thought that was fortuitous. And it was the right script for me. And it had two women producers, a woman writer, two female stars, you know, and everything kind of fell into place.
Susan Seidelman is our guest. The name of the new book is Desperately Seeking Something. An evening with Susan Seidelman will be taking place on Wednesday, July 17th at 7 p.m. at Images Cinema in Williamstown, Massachusetts. And you can find out more about that event by going to imagescinema.org. So when you get that script and you look, are the names immediately attached of Madonna and Rosanna Arquette?
When I got this script, Rosanna had been attached. She had met with the producers. And interestingly, what I later found out was that when she was sent the script, she thought she was reading it for the role of Susan. So she was attached first. Then we started to audition some other actors for the role of Susan. And at that time, there were a lot of young up-and-coming actresses who were just starting out their career. So I remember meeting with Melanie Griffith, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Jamie Lee Curtis, Linda Fiorentino, Kelly McGillis, who were all up-and-coming at that time. And they all would have been great. They just would have been a different version of Susan. As it turned out, I was living downtown Manhattan in the Soho area, and a few streets away from me was this young singer named Madonna. And her career was just beginning to start. It was just starting out. I had seen a video she had done on early MTV. It was a video for the song Borderline. And while I was watching it, I thought she had great style. She was really interesting and she knew how to flirt with the camera. And I thought, and I had heard she wanted to be an actress, but she hadn't done anything before. And I thought if I could capture that quality of the early Madonna and incorporate that with the character of Susan, that she could be pretty interesting on film. But I then had to convince the studio to make it with her because they didn't know who she was at the time.
And they didn't know who she was at the time, but by the time it's made, then she's exploding, right?
Well, it was fascinating to watch that happen. When we started the film, the first day of shooting, we were filming out on the street and, you know, in New York City, and people would pass by, see a camera, you know, some crew hanging around, but they really weren't paying that much attention. They didn't see any movie stars. And then by the time we finished filming, 9 weeks later, we literally needed security guards to keep the crowds away, because during those 9 weeks, her Like a Virgin album came out and her career skyrocketed. And so quickly, I had never seen that happen. And suddenly the movie was referred to as the Madonna movie. And it was good timing for me, because I didn't have to deal with any star ego or any of the complications of working with a big star while we were filming. But then we had the benefit for the release of the movie and the publicity.
That seems to be very, I mean, to have it timed that way, I guess in retrospect, is the best case scenario, because otherwise it could have been, or probably would have been, impossible.
Well, what was interesting is, I think a lot of luck is involved in success. You have to be there with the right thing, but then you have to be lucky too. And timing is so important. And it was funny because after we finished filming, and by that time, Orion, the studio, was very aware that Madonna was a star, but they didn't know how long her stardom would last. So originally we were scheduled for about 5 months of pre-production, and the pre-production was rushed. We were scheduled for 5 months, and it was pushed to 3.5 months because they were afraid her star would rise and fall again by the time the movie was released.
What do you think, when you look back in that film, what do you think that it accomplished and its place in cinema today?
Well, to be quite honest, I never expected that we would be talking about it like this, and that it would still be, you know, available, you know, still be not just available for streaming, but also playing in repertory movie theaters,
right,
almost 40 years later. So that's a surprise. But I also think it showed that women could make movies that could succeed commercially and critically at the box office. It showed that, you know, it was sort of the start of a lot of other women directors suddenly getting the opportunity to make movies, and movies that had a female point of view that could also be appreciated by men. But clearly you could feel a woman's hand directing them. So that was gratifying.
You write about this, and I'm interested that it is, your films are being criticized like all other films. They have critics. In this case, most of the critics are men. How did you come to terms with that at the time? Or do you ever feel that you ever did fully come to terms with that?
Well, you have to come to terms with it if you want to play in this field, because you're always going to get criticized. There's people who are going to love it, and there's going to be people who are going to hate what you're doing. But I think you have to kind of develop a slightly tougher skin and let some of that stuff, you know, wash over you. Although, you know, I'm friendly with actors and other writers and directors who say they don't read reviews. I'm not sure I totally believe that. I do. And it does hurt when somebody says something or misinterprets your intention. I think that's the hardest thing. I can deal with somebody saying, I just don't like this story. But when they misinterpret what you were going for, it does hurt. Or maybe you start to question yourself. Maybe I wasn't clear enough about stating my intention or my point of view.
When Desperately Seeking Susan comes out, it's 1985. Mm-hmm. And then it's like the next thing, right? It's immediately, you have a 4-picture deal and it's what you do next. How hard was that for you?
Well, it was a 3-picture deal, and it was, I mean, I was thrilled. Let me be honest. I was very thrilled that a studio wanted to make a 3-picture deal with me. But there is a certain amount of pressure. And when I made Smithereens, my first indie movie, there was no pressure because I didn't think anyone was going to see it. I just wasn't thinking commercially. when I made Desperately Seeking Susan, that was a surprise. I mean, we hoped people would like it, but we didn't know it would be a commercial success and that it would get talked about so much, which was even more important to me, that people were, it was a part of a conversation that was interesting. So suddenly I felt there were people looking over my shoulder, and I was nervous that whatever I did next, you know, people were watching, and that for somebody who wasn't used to that, that is something I needed to adjust to.
And right after it was Making Mr. Right, again, a romantic comedy, but with a science fiction twist. And oh, by the way, John Malkovich.
An early John Malkovich. He hadn't made a comedy before. In fact, he had only made maybe one or two, but I'm only aware of one other movie, which was called Places in the Heart. And it was a dramatic role that he played. But that was a really fun movie to make. And weirdly enough, it got mixed reviews when it came out, but it's now getting a little bit of a buzz because it is an AI romantic comedy, and suddenly right. AI is in the news.
Later came She-Devil, and it just, I as I was reading the book, I thought, wow, no one would think today of casting Roseanne Barr and Meryl Streep together. But at the time, it made sense.
Well, it's a movie about opposites. I mean, there's the two main characters are two very different women. And what better contrast than having the most esteemed dramatic actress playing the comedic role and the, at the time, most popular TV comedian playing the dramatic role? For me, again, it's always interesting to work with people or actors in ways you haven't seen them before. So this was Meryl Streep's first comedy. She's a brilliant actress and has brilliant timing. So I hoped and knew she would do a great job in that role. And Roseanne Barr really was like the character she played in the movie, a frumpy housewife who managed to gain power. I mean, let's remember she was this Midwestern comedian who right. managed to succeed in the sitcom world that was very male dominated at that time.
And got middling reviews, I guess, is the best way to describe it. But Meryl Streep was nominated for a Golden Globe.
Yes, she was. But interestingly enough, I found that with several of my films, and maybe because they were a little ahead of their time, I don't know, but films that were not as fully appreciated as I had hoped at the time are now sort of being re-looked at through a contemporary lens and looked at differently. So that I'm finding very gratifying.
When you see that at the time, and as you say, gratifying now, but when it doesn't hit at that moment when you're just coming out of it and just finishing the project, does that impact what you do next? Does that impact how of what the next project is going to be and how you decide to move forward?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when you have a hit movie, everyone's sending you their scripts. And when you have something that isn't commercially successful, it gets harder to grab the attention of the head of the studio who needs to greenlight your next movie. And you find yourself, I mean, quite frankly, the term is movie jail. I think after after She-Devil, I was in movie jail for a while, and what revived my career was television. You know, I went on to do some good TV movies and the pilot for Sex and the City, but certainly right after She-Devil, the heads of the studios were not calling me to do their next film. But I've learned that if you want a long-term career, you have to ride the ups and downs of the roller coaster. And the film business is definitely like a roller coaster ride.
Where are you in the roller coaster right now?
Well, right now, after doing, a movie career, a TV career, and now I just put out a book, I am waiting to see where things will take me. What I'm doing is I can't stop being a storyteller. I love telling stories. Whether I write another book, whether I've been taking notes about something, whether it turns into a TV series, because let's face it, the movie business has changed dramatically over the past decade. I grew up and, I only wanted to make movies for a big screen. I had no interest when I started out in the 80s wanting to direct television. And now it's all about TV and streaming and series and limited series. That's where TV has gone. I mean, that's where the culture has gone. Would I want to direct a TV series or a limited series? Absolutely, if it was the right project.
Well, in the meantime, the new book is out. It is an absolute delight. Desperately Seeking Something is the name of the book. And Susan Seidelman will be a part of an evening with Susan Seidelman on Wednesday, July 17th at 7 p.m. at Images Cinema in Williamstown, Massachusetts, in a conversation with the ever wonderful Jessica Hecht, one of my favorite humans in the world. And you get to watch the film, and then you will see Susan in conversation with Jessica, and then you'll sign books. That sounds like a pretty wonderful evening.
Sounds like fun to me. Thank you for having
Absolutely.
me on your show. I appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure to have you again, Susan Seidelman. Thank you so much. Be well. Again, Susan Seidelman will be a part of an evening with Susan Seidelman in conversation with Jessica Hecht. The event is Wednesday, July 17th at 7 p.m. You can find out more information by going to imagescinema.org, imagescinema.org. The name again of the new book is Desperately Seeking Something. It's published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.